Welcome to Life Solved, the research podcast from the University of Portsmouth, where we explore how studies here are changing our world today and in the future. I'm John Worsey, a writer at the University of Portsmouth, and your host for this week's episode of Life Solved. All of us involved in Life Solved are thrilled to see that we have an international listenership for this podcast. A lot of you probably have English as a second, third, or even fourth language. And whether you're a native English speaker or not, we think you'll find plenty of interest in this week's episode. It's UN English Language Day on Wednesday, the 23rd of April. So this week, we consider how English became one of the world's most widely spoken languages. And we find out how a mathematical model developed here at the University of Portsmouth might predict the future of the language. Let's begin by looking to the past. Dr. Mario Saraceni is Associate Professor in English Language and Linguistics here at the University. As he's about to explain, the history of what we call English begins with a very different language brought to Britain by the Anglo-Saxons, immigrants from places now known as Germany and Scandinavia.
The popular narrative says that the English language kind of began in the 5th century with the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons, and then it kind of went through phases of evolution, like, you know, Old English and Middle English and Early Modern English and so on. For example, if you look at what we now call Old English, if anyone reads it or tries to read it, they won't be able to. They won't be able to understand very much at all. So Old English, from a purely linguistic point of view, is very much another language. Yeah. And the reason why we call it Old English is because essentially it serves the narrative of the national identity. If you look at when the term Old English began to be used, it was in the 19th century. And the 19th century is a very important period in European history because it was pretty much the apex of nationalism. And national identities were being formed, and also they needed these stories. And the fundamental aspect of the national story was the language. So from a linguistic point of view, Old English is very much a different language. But from a national identity point of view, we call it English for that reason. So in reality, the English language didn't really begin at any particular point because languages are constantly evolving.
So there's power in words. And that brings us to the next chapter in the story of the English language, the British Empire.
When we talk about the British Empire, we're really talking about nearly 400 years of history, from the 15th century, or 16th century rather, you know, up to the middle of the 20th century. So if you think about that, the empire expanded and the English language expanded with it. So you have places like North America, areas of Africa, Australia, New Zealand, areas of South Asia, Southeast Asia. The English language arrived in all these places with the empire. And what happened was that with time, the English language kind of found itself in these different socio-cultural environments and kind of therefore, as a consequence of that, developed new features and new flavors almost, and new varieties of English began to emerge with time. So now, for example, everybody or most people are familiar with terms like American English or Australian English, you know, and these are the products of that kind of expansion. But besides those, you also have lots of other Englishes in the plural, like Indian English or Nigerian English or Malaysian English and Singaporean English and so on and so forth. These are all, if you like, byproducts of empire.
The empire had different effects on language around the world, depending on the nature of the colonization. For example, in North America and Australia, British settlers became a majority population by force, and English became the dominant language. Elsewhere, English coexisted with indigenous languages, and it began to evolve, absorbing cultural and linguistic elements from its surroundings. But not all these variations of English are equal in power, as Mario explains.
All these forms of English, all these varieties of English are linguistically equal, So from the point of view of language, and let's say their value is exactly the same, there's nothing, you know, superior or inferior between one variety and another variety. But in terms of prestige and in terms of power, and therefore in terms of legitimacy, there's huge inequality. So if you look at British English and American English, for example, they enjoy a huge amount, a greater prestige and power around the world than, say, Pakistani English or Nigerian English or South African English and so on and so forth. So in terms of recognition, these varieties sit a lot lower on some kind of prestige and power hierarchy. And what is interesting about that as well is that the perception of those Englishes as being somewhat inferior is also felt by the speakers themselves. And, you know, anecdotally, you know, this makes me think of this particular YouTuber who's someone who is originally from Malaysia. His name is Nigel Ng, and has acquired a lot of fame on YouTube. You know, he started doing these videos where he is reacting on people preparing Asian food, right? So different cooks around the world, quite famous ones as well, like Jamie Oliver or whoever. And he kind of reacts to these videos, and they're kind of funny videos because he's like basically criticizing how these people can cook Asian food, right? What he does though, so he has this kind of alter ego called Uncle Roger. And Uncle Roger is someone who speaks in a very sort of marked Malaysian English form, so very local to where he originally came from. And then Nigel Ng himself, so the author of Uncle Roger, if you like, speaks in a very, very international and internationally intelligible English. The kind of, you know, vaguely American, but not quite strongly American. The kind of English that is like a jet setter kind of English. Someone who travels around the world and has a kind of really fairly neutral way of speaking English. He says in various interviews that if he carried on speaking in his Malaysian way, he would not be taken seriously. So he uses the Malaysian variety of English for his character, but then in his real life, so to speak, he uses this international form of English. I mean, he doesn't use these words, but fundamentally what he's saying is that these two forms of English are unequal. So the Malaysian English wouldn't carry enough weight, and therefore he chooses to use this international form of English. That's what he finds more successful.
And in a globalized world, the dominant form of English is no longer the one we speak in England.
American English has become incredibly powerful in the last, say, 100 years as a direct result of America, or the United States, I should say, being a superpower. So superpower, military power, economic power, cultural power. Think about, you know, popular culture and all the popular culture that comes from America. All of that contributes, has contributed and continues to contribute to the rise of American English as the most powerful variety of English nowadays.
It's time to look at some numbers. It's thought that around 2 billion people speak English worldwide. The population of the UK, just 70 million. Not only is English evolving outside of its namesake nation, but the changes are also shaping how Brits themselves speak their own language.
Out of 2 billion people, we're talking about 300 million users of American English, more or less, yeah? So it's still a minority. But the power of American English is so great that American English actually influences other varieties of English as well, including British English. So you have features of American English that are quite literally traveling around the world and finding themselves in other varieties of English, including British English. Things like, for example, think about very, very common colloquial way of saying, when somebody asks, how are you? Until fairly recently, the normal way to respond to that was fine, or thank you, with an adverb. It's increasingly common now to say good. How are you? Good. That good comes from American English. Yeah. Even like little things like the replacement of the verb have, as in, can I have a pint of beer, with can I get. Now, get, again, is something that comes from American English. And what is interesting about these things is that these aren't changes that people are necessarily aware of. And they're certainly not aware of the fact that this is the influence of American English.
But don't assume that globalization and factors like the internet are only reshaping English. They're also holding it together and reinforcing its position as a global language.
So the English language has diversified in the last, say, 200-300 years. You've got different varieties of English. Now, if you look at it from that point of view, you can almost imagine a language that continuously gets increasingly diversified, okay? But at the same time, what's also happening is that there are really big, powerful forces that keep the language together, right? So at one time, you have what we call centrifugal forces that kind of pull English apart. And then we have centripetal forces that push it back together. The centripetal forces are fundamentally the forces of globalization. So in globalization, we have communication that happens around the world. We have technology that makes that kind of communication incredibly easier. So you have platforms like TikTok, and you have YouTube, and you have things like that, whereby people in Malaysia and people in America and people in Europe and people in Africa communicate with one another so easily now. And that form of communication is mostly English. And what that means is that English is also, apart from being diversified, is also kind of becoming a bit more homogeneous, because that kind of global communication is bringing everything back together.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lucinda King, Space Projects Manager from the University of Portsmouth's Faculty of Technology. This episode of Life Solved offers a glimpse into our diverse portfolio of research, which is united by the question, how do we make tech, engineering and science more relevant to global well-being? Our pursuit of answers ranges from health informatics and computational intelligence to new energy sources and the nature of space-time. If this podcast has you feeling inspired, you can find out how to support our research, collaborate or study with us at www.port.ac.uk.
So, how will the English language evolve from here? Answers may be on the way, thanks to the work of another researcher here at Portsmouth. Dr. James Burridge is Associate Professor in Probability and Statistical Physics. And there's something important he needs you to know.
I'm not a linguist. I'm a sort of cross between a physicist and a mathematician. An enthusiast for probability.
James's way into our story is not what you'd expect. It all started with magnets.
So I'm sort of generally interested, or have been interested, in mathematical processes which generate patterns. One way you can get patterns is through a process called phase ordering. The kind of classic example of that is in a magnet. What makes a magnet magnetic is the fact that the atoms within it align their magnetic directions. And if you make a magnet very hot, then all the directions randomly orientate, and as you cool it down, there's a critical point where they start to align, but they don't necessarily align in the same direction everywhere. And what you find is you get these big patches of the magnet where they all align, and other patches where they align in a different direction, and boundaries between them. And those boundaries behave like bubbles. And one of the things I thought would be interesting is to see if there are alignment processes like that in culture or language in the real world that would be described by the same maths.
James tested this idea on a species of bird. The Puget Sound white-crowned sparrow is found on the Pacific Northwest coast of the USA.
Their breeding grounds are kind of like a strip, and there's no genetic difference between the birds all the way down the strip, but over very short distances, the terminal trill of their mating call switches from one form to another. So you get these kind of bands where all the males sing the same song, then suddenly it changes, and suddenly it changes, and suddenly it changes. So one of the first things I did was to map the life cycle of those birds onto one of these classical physics models of magnets and tried to predict the patterns that would emerge in those species and check that the statistics of those patterns match the actual statistics of the patterns we see, the ornithologists observe.
So looking at that ornithological data, then you found that actually this was a pretty close map, or it wasn't exact, right?
If you're looking at statistics, it's never exact. But the statistics are the same in the sense that there's no good evidence that the model is wrong.
James started applying the model to data on the English language. Two of his key collaborators are Dr. Tamsin Blackster and Professor Bert Vaux, both linguists at the University of Cambridge. James made some interesting discoveries.
I discovered after doing the bird work that human languages have these lines called isoglosses, which are geographical lines where when you cross them, some little feature of the language switches from one form to another. Not all features behave in that way, but some do. So, for example, what's called the trap bath split.
To summarise this, I say trap with an A sound on the letter A and bath with an R sound on the A. But if I'd grown up further north in England, there's a good chance I'd apply that A sound to both words, trap and bath. Here's James.
Really good data has been collected on the form of trap and bath that people use based on where they live or where they think they'd picked up their language. And there's a very, very sharp isogloss which stretches from the Wash on the east coast to sort of somewhere around Bristol on the west coast. So there's a very sharp dividing line for that particular linguistic feature. Then there's millions of these isoglosses. I constructed a model of language evolution based on the idea that you have a memory and you fill up your memory with linguistic features, and then you take that memory and then you apply what I call a learning function to that memory to get your own linguistic state, and then solve the equations on the UK to begin with, which depend on population density and as well as the shape of the UK, and predicted where I thought all the isoglosses should end up. And you get, you know, reasonably good agreement with where they actually are. The interesting thing about it is you get a set of physical principles which tell you how isoglosses should evolve. So, for example, they should get shorter, they should straighten, they should get pushed away from cities, and they should collect in indentations in the coastline. So there's lots of isoglosses that emerge from the Wash, which is a big indentation in the East Coast. And I would say that that's because the surface tension effect, because the isoglosses behave like the surfaces of bubbles, that the Wash should collect bubble surfaces. And there's a good sort of physics-based reason why that should happen.
So there you have it. Think of an isogloss as an invisible border protecting pronunciation. But those borders shift and change over time, for example, with the population. If a way of speaking becomes dominant enough in a local population, it can overcome an isogloss.
If you have a region which has a particular linguistic feature, as long as the migration rate into that region is sufficiently slow, then the desire of young speakers to conform with local features is able to overcome that migration, because instead of picking up their parents' speech, they pick up the local speech. That there is a critical migration rate, according to our model, where that can't happen anymore. So if you, I think what you and I would call a splinter, a little bit of wood stuck in your finger, there used to be a very large number of different words for a splinter. Now splinter dominates almost everywhere in England, other than Newcastle, where for some reason spelk is still common. And that is more or less predictable because Newcastle is a dense area but surrounded by empty space. And that means that the repulsion effect of the spelk isogloss is able to keep splinter out.
So Newcastle upon Tyne is like that plucky little village in Gaul from the Asterix comics, holding out against the Roman Empire. A modern-day linguistic Caesar seeking to dominate the English language would be keen to have a word with James, because his model is on its way to predicting where English goes from here.
the original work was purely theoretical, but with a bit of comparison to kind of classic dialect maps. What we're interested in now is what's the predictive power of the model. And if you want to test the predictive power of a model, what you need is a sequence of observations of the process you're trying to predict, and you want to fit the model to early ones and see if you can predict the later ones. So it's remarkably difficult to do that in linguistics because there's basically no longitudinal data, except in special cases. So we have this two big surveys. So there's the Survey of English Dialects done in the 1950s, collecting the speech of people born around the turn of the 20th century. And then there was a new survey done called the English Dialect App. It was a kind of gamified app which collected people's linguistic features. And that collected similar features, or a subset of the features in the English Dialect survey, but around 2016. So we've got the same set of linguistic features separated by about roughly 100 years. So we set the model off, the physics off, 100 years ago, just let it roll forward, had a look and see how many of the 20th century features were predicted by the simplest form of the model. So good chunk of them were. And where they weren't, we said, OK, that must mean that there are some biases involved here. So things like, you know, American influence or perhaps linguistic effects, prestige effects. And we figured out what those biases would need to be to hit the 20th century distributions from the end of the 19th century.
So kind of reverse engineered the model, essentially. So that
yes, but of course, you've only got 2 points in time there. So what we're doing now is trying to actually test the predictive power. So calibrate for 30 years, see if we can predict the next 30 years.
It's early days, but the model's predictive powers are in development. The test case was what's known as the foot-strut split. Like Trap Bath, this is a matter of a north-south divide in pronunciation, with southerners typically pronouncing foot and strut differently, whereas someone from northern England is more likely to say foot and strut. James's model suggests that separation will disappear this century. By 2066, we'll all be saying strut. You're probably already imagining that the possibilities for this modelling work are huge. And you're right, James can't give too much away today. But here's what he can tell us.
We just put in a grant application to do a sort of full-blown multinational model, and then to produce the tools on a website, have a kind of web tool which would allow you to predict not just language but culture forward in time, so different cultural and linguistic features. We're hoping to learn a really good predictive model of lots of different features and be able to run them forward, and to allow people to sort of change the physics, change the social physics, and experiment with what's going to happen if it changes. So change migration rates, change conformity, change biases, and watch what they think will happen.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. Seriously. We need to work together.
Yeah, I think, I think yeah. That there's a fertile ground. It's these linguists, you know, you guys know so many interesting things, but it really is, it just looks so much like a physics system. And there must be...
I mean, talking about interdisciplinarity doesn't go any better than this, does it?
I think it's a good one. It's a good matchup. Yeah.
It really doesn't get any better than that, does it? Two experts from wildly different disciplines unravelling the evolution of one of the world's most commonly spoken languages. And with every day that passes from here, we'll get a step closer to being able to predict the future of any language, given big enough data, big enough brains, and a passion for asking the big questions. Thanks for listening to this episode of Life Solved. You're very welcome to be part of the discussion. Email us at lifesolved@port.ac.uk. That's lifesolved, one word, @port.ac.uk. Tell us what you think and make suggestions for future episodes of Life Solved. And we'd love it if you clicked follow on your podcast app so you never miss an episode. We'd really appreciate it if you left a rating or review as well, because that helps us get these conversations into more ears around the globe. If you've been inspired by this episode and you want to support our work, then head to port.ac.uk/lifesolved to find out how. Bye for now.